It's a story that sounds fit for an espionage novel. Tech hackers and software pirates, former intelligence agents, stolen emails, a mysterious suicide, and a dozen rambunctious orphans. Okay, no orphans, but everything else actually happened. We know that now from a lawsuit 5 years in the making. It's finally gotten to a court in California. This is all extremely vague, but I hope compelling. Kim Zetter, correspondent for Wired.com, is here. Hey, Kim.
Good morning.
So I have set out absolutely no facts of this very fascinating case, but I hear a lawsuit is going on. Can you summarize who's suing who?
Yeah, it gets a little confusing because there are a number of players here, but essentially EchoStar, which is a runs the Dish Network, which is pay TV service, has access cards that were made by a company called Negristar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Negristar's major competitor is a UK-Israeli company called NDS Group.
Mm-hmm.
And NDS Group's cards are used in DirecTV's satellite system.
So, on one side we have, let's just talk about the consumer brands that everyone knows. It's basically on one side Dish Network and a lot of subsidiaries, and the other side it's DirecTV.
Yes, those are the pay TV services, but underlying the lawsuit are actually the makers of the cards that are used with each system.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the lawsuit is based.
Okay.
So essentially what's happening is that Negristar is accusing NDS of hacking its access cards, basically reverse engineering it, deciphering the encryption scheme on it, and designing a method by which pirates could then bypass Negristar's encryption.
Okay, so we got these two huge satellite providers. They have subsidiaries and people giving them business. Dish Network says, or their subsidiary says, they were wronged, and the people who wronged them were the Rupert Murdoch News Corp-owned DirecTV people, NDS. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. And there is hacking involved and piracy involved? Is it just all dirty tricks trying to screw with the competitor?
Well, you know, NDS is basically saying that reverse engineering systems is kind of standard operating procedures to, you know what a competitor is up to, understand the system and things like that.
What is, well, before I even ask, and that's going to be my next question, so prepare, what's reverse engineering?
What
are these cards? What are we talking about here?
Well, an access card is basically a smart card that allows your set-top box to basically access the digital content.
Mm-hmm.
And it has an encryption key that basically tells the system, okay, I'm a legitimate customer and I can access this this content. Now, reverse engineering is essentially taking something apart to figure out how it works. And in the case of taking apart the smart card, it's a pretty involved process that requires an electron microscope. It can take 6 months to a year to do this. You're basically extracting the code from the memory chip and figuring out how it works, and figuring out what those secret keys are.
So the Rupert Murdoch-owned DirecTV NDS subsidiary actually started hacking the competitor's cards?
Yes, in a lab in Haifa, Israel.
Israel?
Yes.
Why'd they do it there?
Well, NDS started out as an Israeli startup company, and then News Corporation invested in it. So NDS is about 80% owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation.
And is with the Israel connection, is that where the former intelligence agents I spoke of come in?
Some of them, yes.
Some of them. There are others out there. Tell me about these guys.
Yeah, there's an American one as well.
Oh, good.
Yes, the NDS group has on its head of its security team is a former deputy head of Israel's domestic security agency, Shabak or Shin Bet.
Oh, wow.
So he's head of security head of Israel. The American version, or the American division of NDS, also has a former intelligence official on its security team here. And the UK version of NDS has a former Scotland Yard commander.
Is that common, these high-profile and acclaimed people?
It is becoming much more common. In NDS's case, the reason that they say that they hired these intelligence people is because they wanted them to actually go after pirates.
Okay.
NDS was actually hacked first. So its system was initially hacked, and pirates were getting DirecTV content for free. And so this is the charge. This is the center of the charge is that Negristar is saying because NDS was hacked back in around 1995, 1996, they say NDS wanted to even the playing field and make everyone hacked. So they're saying that NDS, once they were hacked, essentially then hired the people who hacked its cards and the pirates who were stealing its.
So revenge hacking and pirates. Is the idea to steal their secrets, or is the idea just to hurt them business-wise by allowing all their content to be free everywhere?
Yes, and NDS was at risk at the time that its cards were hacked. It was at risk of losing DirecTV as a client.
Oh, because it couldn't show that they could secure the cards, which is the key to the whole business. And it's a big business, right? Give us some idea of the money involved.
Oh, it's huge. Hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in revenue in terms of the content. And DirecTV and Dish Network are the primary providers here in the U.S. So it's the entire U.S. market, essentially. They have subsidiaries in Europe and everywhere else.
In the industry, was this a shock to people who follow it, or does everyone know that this real underhanded stuff goes on?
I don't think anyone is shocked. I think we're seeing a lot more of these espionage cases mm-hmm. and sabotage cases coming forward, and that's what's so interesting about this case is that there are a lot of players who are talking in this. There are a lot of affidavits from the hackers and the pirates who are disclosing this information. And, we have seen, there have been a couple of other kind of high-profile espionage cases, but this is going to become more and more commonplace.
What are the hackers saying? What have we heard from hackers?
Well, one of the major hackers that was hired is a German, Oliver Kummerling, who wrote basically the primer on hacking smart cards. And he was hired by NDS, and he's come forward in an affidavit, and he says that he helped actually set up the lab in Israel to do this. And that the Israeli engineers did it basically using his techniques.
Is he just a smart guy who knows how to do it, or was he a criminal at one point?
No, he was a brilliant security researcher, and
right.
and they've hired him for his knowledge. Now, the other guy, who was an American hacker, named Christopher Tarnowski, was hired by NDS as an engineer, and he is being accused of writing the program. Once the cards were cracked and the code was obtained, he's accused then of being hired by NDS to write a program that could actually reprogram the Negristar cards to allow pirates to use them.
Oh, so the idea there is that the Rupert Murdoch-owned DirecTV subsidiary NDS would just be pirating their competitors' products.
Yes.
Wow. And does Tarnowski, I mean, his testimony, does it seem credible?
Well, he is not testifying against NDS at this point. I should step back. There was a previous case in which he did. It involved Canal Plus, which was also satellite TV in France. They were initially suing NDS for the same thing. They said that they hacked their cards as well.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Tarnowski told the head of security at Canal Plus that he would testify against NDS. Or he implied nonverbally, this is what Canal Plus is saying,
he
implied nonverbally that NDS was responsible for the hacking, and he said that he would testify, but he later backed out on that and said that he feared for his safety.
Well, what we could say is subterfuge, intrigue, and billions of dollars. Kim Zetter, correspondent for Wired.com. Thanks a lot, Kim.
Thank you.
This is the BPP from NPR News. On Mondays, we focus on technology. Today, we look at websites that bring hungry web surfers together with their favorite foods. Plenty of sites on the internet allow ordinary people to review restaurants, and good reviews on sites like Chowhound and Yelp can help a restaurant. Now, tech-savvy food lovers are creating a new kind of culinary website that steers people towards smaller, harder-to-find eateries. Cyrus Farivar reports.
It's a Friday evening in Sacramento, California, and Joshua Lurie Terrell is setting out for an early dinner at one of his favorite taco trucks in the northern part of town.
Dos lenguas? I have a bottle of water, too. What do you want?
He's the creator of YumTacos.com, an online map of taco trucks in the United States. It's a great example of a new category of websites that alerts people to small restaurants that probably would never make it into a fancy food guide. It focuses primarily on California. Lurie Terrell lives here in Sacramento.
You know, I was keeping a list. I carry a little notebook usually around with me. I don't have it right now. And I was keeping a list, and as soon as a couple of friends of mine knew I had this list, people were calling me all the time saying, you know, I'm in the South area. I'm really hungry. It's like 10 o'clock. I had pho already this week. I need something different. I'd say, oh, taco truck at, you know, the corner of 65th and Stockton, and there they were.
From there, it was a short leap to compiling this information on an online map. He's a graphic designer by trade and loves maps. Plus, his wife is a cartographer. Once he had the map, people from around the country started writing in.
There's several in Baltimore, Maryland, which was kind of surprising to me. I've been to Baltimore many times, and it did not seem like the kind of place where you had any hope of finding authentic Mexican food.
Lurie Terrell is turning people onto small businesses that they might not otherwise find. One of the earliest food maps was made by Adam Kubin, the founder of SliceNY.com, a blog devoted to pizza, and specifically New York pizza.
I could just as easily put the pizzerias in a list, say, in the sidebar or some such. But the advantage of having it on a map is that it's visual and people can click on it. They can zoom in to their neighborhood and see, like, hey, there's five pizza slices here, which is what I use on the map, pizza slices, for my pinpoints. That means there's good stuff around me, and then they can go and look and see where it is.
But what if your neighborhood is the entire country? That was the problem for Brian Huey, a graduate student at the University of Southern California who splits his time between Los Angeles and the Bay Area. Huey is like a lot of Chinese immigrants who don't cook. They comprise a large market of people nationwide who want a little taste of home. That's how ChineseFoodMap.com was born, an entirely Chinese language site with reviews plotted in major metro areas around the country, including Houston, Seattle, and Atlanta. But chances are, your favorite local Chinese restaurant isn't on the list.
The Chinese restaurant for Chinese here and the Chinese restaurant for non-Chinese is kind of totally different. That's why Chinese people need a website for themselves.
If you can't read Chinese and feel like you're missing out on the good stuff, fear not. Huey wants to help his favorite Chinese restaurants get new, non-Chinese customers. He plans on completing an English version of the site by the end of the summer. For NPR News, I'm Sarus Farivar.
It's not the devices that has one musician concerned. It's the network itself. Damian Kulash is the lead singer and guitarist for the band OK Go. He has this commentary.
For musicians, it's an exciting time because anything could happen. My band's played the standard game. We've toured relentlessly. I mean, more than 500 shows in the last 2 years alone, and we've sold the better part of a million records the old-fashioned brick-and-mortar way. But the thing we're most known for these days? Homemade videos we uploaded to YouTube. They've been streamed more than 50 million times, and we got a Grammy for one of them. Basically, it's totally crazy. This new user-operated music industry is a very weird and occasionally very wonderful place. Musicians who never stood a chance in the lockdown systems of the past are finally getting their shot. The question we all have, of course, is where's the rent going to come from? The old gatekeepers were the major labels, the commercial radio stations, MTV, and as everyone knows, they wielded their power ruthlessly. But though they may not have been equitable or generous with the cash they collected, at least the handful of stars they anointed were making good livings, and that fueled the delusion for the rest of us. So for musicians to make decent livings now, do we need new gatekeepers? If not, well, who's collecting the money and from where? If so, who are these new gatekeepers? The online retailers, bloggers, subscription services, Facebook or MySpace? We can let innovation and competition answer these questions, or we can let the telephone and cable companies decide for us. That's what will happen if tiered internet service becomes a reality. It's really all a question of where value comes from in this new universe. It used to come from controlling access, and now it needs to come from somewhere else. People clearly are willing to spend money on music, but as it stands right now, they spend it mostly on hardware or access fees. We spend lots on our iPods, but very little on the files we fill them with. We spend tons on broadband service, but very little on the things we actually download. The genius who figures out how to tease value out of this confusing new world could be 17 and working out of his garage. That's the way it's worked with the great net ideas of the past. But that won't happen if the internet playing field doesn't stay level. If we allow the companies that sell us broadband access to control the market on ideas, we'll be stuck with their ideas. And that's the last thing any of us should want.
That's Damian Kulash. He's the lead singer and guitarist of the band OK Go.
Since a quarter to four, throw on your clothes a second side, a surfer rosa, and you leave me with my jaw on the floor. Just when you think you're in control, just when you think you got a hold, just when you get on a roll. Oh, here it goes, here it goes, here it goes again. Oh, here it goes again. I should've known.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Now to some news that might have passed under your radar. The Nighthawk just flew its final mission. It's an American jet, officially called the F-117A. It was the first stealth fighter built with technology that makes it invisible to radar detection. The Nighthawk has always been, and still is, super classified. The government didn't even acknowledge the jet existed until a decade after it was flying. Its last mission this week? Fly to a secure hangar in Nevada for safekeeping in secret. The man who flew the lead plane in that mission is Colonel John Forsyth, call sign Ripper. Hi there.
Hi, Andrea. How you doing?
Good. Now, you're in your office there at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico.
That's correct.
Do you have a model of the Nighthawk there on your desk?
I sure do. How did you know that?
I just, something in me, I just a guess. So what does this plane look like?
Well, you know, it's got a very distinctive arrowhead shape. That's kind of a top and bottom view. And a side view, it's very flat. It's very pointy in the front and very flat in the back.
It's the plane that I always call the Batman symbol.
It does look like the Batman symbol.
Am I correct in thinking the wings are flat because that scatters radar?
Well, you know, the wings are flat just like any other type of aircraft. What's really unique about the aircraft is the fuselage itself. It's very angular, very faceted, and that is to reflect radar energy off in different directions.
This plane, the Nighthawk, has had a big role in many U.S. conflicts over the past 30 years, both Iraq wars, Serbia, the Panama invasion, just to name a few. How is it used in combat?
Well, it's specifically designed for what we call strategic attack or air interdiction, and that allows us to get into target sets that other aluminum aircraft, as we call them, have much more difficulty because those aircraft have a high reflectivity. The surface-to-air missile operators can see them much more easily than they can see us. So it allows us to go right down to downtown Baghdad, downtown Belgrade, any target set within a country we can get to.
So why is the military retiring the Nighthawk?
It really comes down to capability. And the technology is such today that, you know, we've got the benefit of 20 years of advancements of avionics. And the F-22...
The F-22 is replacing the Nighthawk.
It is, more or less. And it has afterburner, thrust vectoring. It can carry missiles. It can carry a gun to shoot back. It knows when it's being shot at. And it's got defensive systems. And so, you know, and you have about the same, roughly the same signature as the F-117.
Do you think there's anything you'll miss, though, about the Nighthawk?
Oh, certainly. You know, I mean, it is, I think, one thing about the Nighthawk, particularly because of its physical appearance, it's really etched in the national psyche.
Yeah, it's so cool.
It is, and it is still a big draw at air shows. You could park it next to the F-22 and people would come and watch your jet, you know, because it has that Darth Vader appearance. And I think that, combined with the very small family of pilots that flew this, really make it a unique environment here at Holloman. Mm-hmm. There's been more astronauts than there have been guys and gals that have flown the F-117.
Air Force Colonel John Forsyth is commander of the 49th Operation Group. He flew the final mission of the Nighthawk stealth fighter jet last week. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Andrea.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. The way you see yourself online can affect your behavior offline. In other words, if you want to get thin, get a virtual life. That's what researchers at Stanford University say. Jeremy Bailenson is a professor there. He runs something called the Virtual Human Interaction Lab. I talked with him earlier. So what is a virtual human interaction lab?
Well, we're a lab that studies how the human condition has changed given that people tend to spend lots and lots of time in digital space and interacting not with physical people, but with digital representations of other people. So as a lab, we study what's different now that we're interacting with virtual creatures as opposed to physical people.
Okay, and you can use this fancy lab to make me thin?
What we can do is we can show you a model of your optimal self. In two separate studies now, we've demonstrated that the mere act of watching this causes you to see that weight change is possible and that in your optimal self, you can actually lose weight.
So Professor Bailenson, make me thin. You take me into your lab. What do you do with me?
So you walk into the laboratory, and what we do is we take a series of photographs of your head. You then sit down, and we have a team of people in the other room that use modeling graphics software that builds what we call an avatar of you, which is a three-dimensional digital representation that looks just like you, just as if someone had crafted it using a chisel and clay. What we then do is you put on a head-mounted display. It's a fancy helmet. And once you're inside the virtual world, we hit a button and right in front of you pops your virtual self. And your virtual self can do stuff that you've never done. So imagine now that you see your virtual self and your virtual self starts exercising and running on the treadmill. And as you're running, you actually see yourself lose weight.
And so you found that watching the cause and effect happen quickly in virtual reality makes people, I don't know, believe it more? It makes them exercise more in real reality.
There's a psychological concept that's been around for a long time called vicarious reinforcement, which is if I actually see my physical behavior causes weight loss, it enables me to psychologically believe that weight loss is possible. And what we've shown in the lab is that when you do this virtual slimming of the avatar, it then causes people, A, to exercise more in physical space in front of us, and then B, when they come back and report back to us in a week, we've actually found they spent much more time, over an hour a day, exercising.
Okay. So I also understand that you study virtual identity, looking at how differences in how your avatar looks can change the way you feel about how you look in real life.
Right. What we study is in these online worlds, when somebody has an optimal self, how does that change how I think about myself and how I behave in a social manner? Meaning, how do I internalize this new me?
And how do people?
If I put you inside of a virtual simulation and you know you're wearing an avatar that's just a little bit more attractive than the norm, and you then turn around and talk to somebody. If you have an attractive avatar as opposed to a normal avatar, you'll stand about a meter closer to this person. And
in virtual reality.
Well, in the first round of studies, we showed, yes, in virtual reality, you behave more confidently and you're a much more social being when your avatar isn't attractive. When I leave the virtual world, how does this pervade? And we've run a series of studies now. Probably the most stunning data that we found is that, so if I put you in virtual reality and you have an attractive face as an avatar, then an hour later when I put you across the hall, we ask you to set up an online dating profile. And what we do is we ask you to choose people that you think you'd be a good match for, and more importantly, people you think that you'd have a chance with. And what we found is that in virtual reality, an hour prior, if you had an attractive face, when you're later choosing people that you think will be good matches, you pick attractive people. Meaning the confidence you've gotten from having a virtual attractive face pervades in the physical world 1 hour later, such that when you're picking potential mates, you think you've got a shot to be with better looking people.
Jeremy Bailenson, it all sounds interesting, but I can't grasp what it means.
It turns out in our daily life now, we talk on cell phones all the time. Kids play video games more than they even watch movies or TV. There's social networking sites like MySpace and online dating, and now we have virtual worlds like Second Life. The big picture is as we move forward, people spend less and less time talking to physical versions of one another and more time talking to digital versions of one another. And what we're showing at the most fundamental psychological level, how you gesture nonverbally, how you talk, how you pick people that you're going to date, the way that you pick your avatar has very, very drastic effects on how you behave.
Jeremy Bailenson runs the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
So in a lot of ways, the internet cuts out the middleman, right? Musicians can now make music on their own, sell it straight to fans without record labels. Authors can write books and sell them online independently without publishers. And people can express themselves through blogs, cutting out the middleman in the form of that pesky editor, Trish McKinney. Now in the world of video game design, new software is aiming to open up the process to indie game developers who've traditionally been on the outside of this little bubble. But don't count the middleman out entirely, quite yet. There's some money to be made. Here to explain is Jason Killingsworth, Paste Magazine's deputy editor and games editor. Hey, Jason.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing fine. Thanks for joining us. So
yeah.
The first product we want to talk about is Microsoft's new software. It's called XNA, and this is not an acronym, right? It's just XNA.
Right. It's just XNA.
It's just they don't need an explanation.
Is that like DNA? Is that the deal?
You know, I guess. I don't know any – I can't think right off of many words besides xylophone that start with X.
It's so. Just throw an X in everything, make it cool.
It makes
for
it
the
high
kids.
Tech.
Yeah.
Xenophobe, Jason, I don't know. How does this software work? Let's walk through the process of how this works.
Right. Well, they've made the XNA, the initial release of XNA 1.0, it was made available in December of 2006. So it's been around for a little while, but they just released an update, so 2.0 is out now. And you can download the program for free, and it runs on your PC, and it basically provides you with a tool set for designing video games. And, you know, you still have to have a basic understanding of, you know, writing code and programming, but it just makes little things here and there easier and more straightforward to save you time and just be more efficient in the way that these developers are working.
And these, I mean, kind of the exciting part about this is that as a game developer, you now have the opportunity to get your product. Maybe you've been making them before, but now you can get them to the point where people can play them on their actual Xboxes, right? Not just on a PC.
Right. That's one of the most exciting things for the game developers themselves, because you have to realize that these developers, you know, when they were, I don't know, in fourth and fifth grade, they weren't, you know, sitting there on, you know, on their PCs. They were playing Super Mario Brothers and Tetris and, you know, The Legend of Zelda, some of these, you know, really classic 8-bit Nintendo games that have, you know, become these huge worldwide franchises. So the idea of creating something and actually getting to, you know, hold a game controller in your hand when you play it instead of just tapping on the keyboard is hugely enticing and exciting for these developers.
I mean, it's been written, we saw in some of the research, that this is like, if you're in our world, if you're a journalist and you have your first story on NPR or you see your byline in the New York Times, mm-hmm. as an indie game developer, if you have your first game on Xbox, that's a big deal, right?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, you were talking about distribution in the intro, and that's been a huge hurdle for a lot of these, you know, small developers, you know, single developers or small teams of two or three developers, and you know, there haven't been that many different channels to get your games out into the world. I mean, people have been, you know, in the indie games community has been just thriving, and it's been growing all the time. But now you're finally starting to see these ways to reach millions instead of just a few people who happen to stumble across this, you know, site on the internet where they're being made available.
So millions of people could potentially be downloading these. Clearly somebody is making a little money off this situation, right?
Yeah, you know, right now Microsoft's Xbox Live service has 10 million users around the world. So, you know, in the fall when they finally, right now with the XNA program, you can develop the games, play them on your own Xbox, but you can't make them available to the whole Xbox Live community just yet. So that's coming, you know, later this year. But once you can, you know, anybody who's using the Xbox Live service, which has a subscription fee, can get these games, and then the games will, you know, will have a small price tag as well. But then, you know, it's available to the whole community, and of course, you know, Xbox is, and you know, Microsoft is going to, they're going to take a little bit of a cut there.
So describe to us, Jason, what are some of the nuts and bolts of this new software? What are some of the tools that indie game developers are going to get from this that they didn't have access to before?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things is the physics engine aspect of game development. If you have a game where, you know, a character is jumping in the air or, you know, throwing Chinese stars as a ninja or something like that, you have to have physics in that game world that are going, that it's going to reflect, give you some sense of real life. So you sort of take that for granted when you're playing a game like Tetris. You're like, oh, well, the gravity makes the blocks fall. It's like, well, you know, the game designer has to create that gravity inside the game. So with the XNA system, there, even though there isn't a built-in physics engine, there's been a physics engine developed by a guy named Jeff Weber of Farseer Games that you can download for free and pull into the tool set to use in the game. So that's one thing that normally a developer would have to either write their own physics engine or go to, you know, a really, you know, a very well-established company that designed these huge engines. But for the indie developer, that's a huge advantage. And then also just things like controller inputs, you know, to be able to map the controller to the game so that when you hit the A button, you know, your bazooka goes off or you hit the B button and you do some huge acrobatic leap in the air. You know, having that already worked into the program where you don't have to write the code to get all
It's very important to have the bazookas go off on time. That
yeah,
really
you know, you don't want to, like, hit the button to shoot an alien and then, you know, have that be, like, the self-destruct button. Something else, and your head blows up.
So what I thought was interesting about this particularly was that as part of this new push by Microsoft, they're really trying to cultivate a new generation of stars in this industry, right? Specifically, there's this guy, James Silva, who's this up-and-coming indie game developer. They're trying to create more of James Silvas. Describe who this young man is.
Yeah, James Silva is a developer from Utica, New York, and he designed this game called Dishwasher Dead Samurai.
Which sounds awesome.
Yeah, I know. You want to buy it already?
I do.
And he won... Microsoft came up with this contest called Dream Build Play, and it was a way to start getting people interested in the XNA service. And he actually was one of two sort of winners who shared the grand prize from the first Dream Build Play contest. And at this past February's Game Developers Conference, he really was sort of brought out on stage at the Microsoft keynote and, you know, put out there sort of this rock star, basically, of indie game design. And it was funny because, you know, everyone on the stage was wearing, you know, all the Microsoft execs had on their suits and ties and were looking super professional. And then out strolls James wearing, like, a hoodie sweatshirt and, you know, in jeans.
All indie.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but this is, like, the new MySpace artist of indie game development.
But do you think he wants to be an indie gamer, or he'd rather just get gobbled up for a couple $100,000 by one of the established gaming companies, if he's so good?
Yeah, you know, I talked to him about that, actually, and he said he really enjoys, you know, kind of the small shop feel of it, and, you know, these huge developers, Activision, and you know, who make great games, Call of Duty 4, Guitar Hero, they have enormous teams that are working on these games. And so I think it depends on what you want. I mean, some people want, you know, to use the musician analogy, and some artists want to be in a huge band with, you know, where there are 20 instruments, you know, something like the Polyphonic Spree. And then some people just want to be a singer-songwriter, and they want to have, you know, just control over every aspect of the sound.
It sounds, I mean, this is clearly similar to what's happened in music, right, with editing software and Pro Tools. Do you see a larger trend here in gaming and media in general?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just starting to happen in the gaming world, but, I mean, as you mentioned, this is something that, you know, the internet has sort of blown wide open, that the means of distribution have been handed to you and me and, you know, and the guy next door. You know, we can get online, set up a blog in 2 seconds and, you know, be, you know, writing for a potential worldwide audience. And, you know, it's happened in every media with iTunes and other websites like that. You can, you know, record a CD in your basement and all of a sudden, you know, be able to put it out into the world without even getting a CD pressed.
Well, until they come up with software that's basically the dummy's guide to creating a video game, I still probably am not capable enough.
Well, it's funny to say that because there, you know, XNA, you have to have the programming background, but there are other game people who are designing these game development tools who want to lower the bar even further.
Sims Carnival.
Yep, yeah,
Electric
exactly.
Arts is doing the Sims Carnival thing. I'm going to look into that because, you know, I might have an inner designer inside me that wants to develop video games. Hey, Jason.
Let him out.
Yeah, let her out. Jason Killingsworth, Pace Magazine's deputy editor and games editor. Jason, we appreciate you being with us today. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Well, ooh, I have some sad news. We meant to hang up on Jason. We wound up setting off a bazooka instead.
Oh,
R bad.
Shoot.
Yeah. Should have pressed B. Next up on the show, the patented segment called the Assisted Listen, where sometimes we talk you through an artist. What we're going to do this time is talk you through an entire genre of music. It's called go-go music. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.